The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Pippa Carrera. After weeks of heartbreaking evidence of the human misery caused by her department's hostile environment strategy, Amber Rudd is out as Home Secretary after misleading Parliament about Home Office deportation targets. But as Sajid Javid takes over, will the policy change or will it just be rebranded?
The phrase hostile is a phrase that I'm not going to use. And it doesn't represent our values as a country to use that phrase. So it's about a compliant environment.
Also this week, hundreds of local council seats are up for election, with Labour expected to have a good night. But with vital local services at stake, will voters come out to the polls? After several bruising parliamentary encounters, at least four separate apologies and more than 2 weeks of negative headlines, Amber Rudd finally resigned as Home Secretary at 10:05 on Sunday night. Her departure came as new evidence emerged that Rudd must, or at least should, have known about government targets for deporting illegal migrants, something she denied in front of a select committee. So after the horrendous tales of British citizens being hassled, denied medical treatment and threatened with deportation by the Home Office, what eventually cost her was a breach of the Westminster rules. I'm joined by Jonathan Friedland and Owen Jones from The Guardian and Katie Bowles from The Spectator. Jonathan, Amber Rudd had defied political gravity for a week of bad headlines, but this didn't come as much of a surprise in the end, did it?
Not by once we were into the weekend, I think, but the stories that were circulating late Friday and into the weekend, which suggested just there were memos, there were documents that she just would have seen, which made impossible her line that she was somehow not aware of these targets. So once you went into the weekend, it was looking really tricky. Until then, I think, you know, if you'd asked me in the middle of last week, would she survive? The motive to keep her in place was so great. Theresa May so wanted her there as this kind of human shield, because otherwise the questions would be about her, that actually I thought she might survive it. But she needed two things to happen. The first is for there to be no documents proving she did know about targets, and she did. Or for somehow the story to go away and for something bigger to have come along, who knows what, but it didn't. And so when the story's going to its second, even almost third week, the combination of those things. But it does, her resignation still puzzles me on some level, which is I just don't understand why she got herself into this tangle over targets. She could have said, of course we had targets for illegal immigration. It was one of our policies. The problem was these people weren't illegal and they should never have been caught up in this dragnet. But she didn't have to deny that the net existed. She just had to say it was bad they got caught in it. And so why she got herself into this mess denying there were targets, even though we know this government is against illegal immigration, that to me remains a puzzle. But anyway, once she was into that logic, yes, it became impossible.
And Katie, talk us through Rudd's approach to the crisis. I mean, as Jonathan said, she rode out the initial scandal. Why then deny the existence of something so easily refutable as a government target?
I think it ultimately came down to competence, and no one in the Conservative Party thought she should quit over the hostile environment policy or even how it was being implemented, because at worst, people thought her greatest sin was not standing up to Theresa May, who's very adamant on this policy. But the reason Theresa May stood for so long in the Home Office, which is seen as a political graveyard, is she is so good at detail. And that's something that Amber Rudd is not so good at. And I think that when she tripped up and didn't know her detail, it got to the point that she couldn't be sure that more damaging documents weren't going to come out. And it also seemed like there were people in the civil service, her civil servants, who were quite keen that she went. And I think it got to the point that she just didn't think she could stand up in the chamber on Monday, go for it, defend her, and not be sure that on Tuesday there wouldn't be another document appearing, perhaps in The Guardian.
And Owen, Rudd was clearly trusted by May. She appointed her as her successor at the Home Office. She even stood in for her at a debate at last year's general election. How big a blow is this personally, her departure personally, for May?
Well, she's lost five cabinet ministers now, hasn't she, since the general election, which is careless, to say the least. I do think, just returning to that earlier point, though, which was, you know, firstly, she did resign on a technicality rather than the nature of the policy. But it's striking, the Home Office is a traditional graveyard of ministerial careers. And actually, where Theresa May has been fortunate is many of the scandals which could have destroyed her own political career, they came to fruition after she left. Police cuts being a striking example. example, but also the consequence of the hostile environment, the Windrush scandal. So I suppose with Amber Rudd resigning, I mean, it helps it in the sense that it is, you know, it has shifted the conversation along. It's seen as, you know, even though she resigned not because of the nature of the scandal, a 62-year-old, for example, who you know, was presented with a bill after brain surgery and then thrown out on the streets and denied a bed in a hostel because even though he'd lived here since he was 16 years old, he wasn't deemed a British citizen, but over whether or not these targets actually existed. But what this has done, I think, is has, if you like, the scandal seems to be directed at Amber Rudd. It hasn't ended up where now there is a relentless focus by the media on Theresa May's own role as the architect of the hostile environment. And the view of the Conservatives, obviously, is, to be honest with you, they think, look at British public opinion on immigration. We're not going to take a big political hit on this. We're just going to rebrand the hostile environment as a compliant environment, but maintain it. Most of the public will think this is an unfortunate scandal, but expect us to continue with that policy. The question is, I think we saw on social security, where attitudes were very hardened for a very long time, but that has shifted because as the consequences of social security cuts bit and the reality sunk in, attitudes began to soften. Will that now happen with immigration as a consequence? And that is something that Theresa May should worry about, because that is how she cemented the Tory base, the 40% or so of the British population who are that core pro-Tory base on issues like immigration. Will that start to soften in the aftermath of this? And they're going to hope it won't.
And on that, Jonathan, how much do you think that British public opinion did sway the politics of all of this? And what does it say more broadly about the state of the debate about migrants, about migration and community relations in Britain at the moment?
It says fascinating things about it, I think, because the government wouldn't have allowed this to have got to the point it got to unless they had underestimated the British public, but also particularly underestimated the British attachment to the Windrush generation. They just hadn't seen that occupies a now perhaps almost mythological place in the kind of British national story. And, you know, there was a small clue in the London 2012 opening ceremony where Windrush was one of the events depicted as if one of the key moments in our national story. So to be on the wrong side of them, and I thought a key moment was that moment with Lenny Henry when he made that remark. These are people who are regarded almost as if Lenny Henry himself is kind of national treasures. They're, you know, and Theresa May realised that when she said, "You're British, you're part of us." But by then it was too late. So I think there was an underestimation of that. But also where they will feel emboldened is they'll feel that this was not a blanket cry from the British public to stand up for all migrants. It was saying specifically, look, we don't have, the polling suggests, we don't have a problem with hostile environment in general, just don't include these people. What's an interesting question now is whether you could test that assumption, which in a way I'm making. If we did, if The Guardian did, heartrending stories of, yes, illegal immigrants, but people with families, with children who need hospital treatment, who are denied it, would the British public again be moved? Would you see even the likes of The Mail and The Telegraph, who did effectively join The Guardian's side on Windrush, would they themselves say, well, look, you know, you shouldn't go after these people, they're vulnerable? That would be interesting. At the moment, the policy post-Windrush is predicated on the assumption of, as long as you don't go after these people, legal British citizens and kind of national, part of, seen as national treasures almost, you're okay. That assumption may be worth challenging, but at the moment I think they'll come away with that conclusion.
And it is striking, actually, that the Tories do keep returning to the issue of illegal immigration in the parliamentary debates on this, and they're doing that because they're hoping that rather than, you know, this continuing focus on a scandal which the vast majority of people find repulsive in the consequences, that they are going to double down on the strength, which is that most people in this country, which I don't like to admit, but it is the reality, are very, very unsympathetic on immigration. A large majority certainly don't have the same views I have, particularly on illegal immigration, on undocumented migrants, as I would call them. And that's why they keep talking about that. They're hoping actually to shift the conversation along. Remember, we're the ones who are toughest on undocumented migrants, and to try and paint Labour as something else, and, you know, the opposite. And I think it's cynical, but it is effective in shoring up their base, no question.
And Katie, the show moved on, if you like, when Sajid Javid made a very pointed intervention on Sunday about this. And by Monday, he was in the House of Commons as Home Secretary.
Yeah, this is actually his second intervention, because when this all began to kick off, and obviously The Guardian had been doing this story for months, but the point at which this became a real problem for the government was when it was reported by The Guardian that that Number 10 had declined a request from Commonwealth leaders to talk about the problem. And Sajid, I think, was the first cabinet minister to take to social media in this way and say, this isn't acceptable, we're looking into it, and voice his concerns. And the impression I've got from speaking to people was that wasn't necessarily an authorised tweet. He just went out and did it. So then in the Sunday Telegraph, we saw him step that up further and basically say that he had personal anger on the issue. I don't think he was auditioning for the job, because I think at that point the Conservative Party were quite keen that Amber Rudd would stay. That's why they were sending politicians onto the Sunday morning shows to try and protect her and stand her up, even though it wasn't particularly successful. But what it did was it meant that when Theresa May had to pick a successor for Amber Rudd, she was more inclined to appoint someone like Karen Bradley, probably quite an uninspiring choice, but a choice who is much more on her wavelength when it comes to immigration and also much easier to control. But I think it was pointed out to her that the gravitas of the situation meant that she really needed to step outside of her comfort box, because that would look like a sign of weakness. And then the most obvious person who would look like they were really going to get a grip on this was Sajid Javid.
I think it's so interesting what you said about the authorised tweet, because I had the same thought went through my mind when he spoke in the House of Commons and said an end to, I don't want to call it hostile environment anymore. And I just thought, was that a sign of strength on his part? That, because you can't imagine Theresa May agreeing to that, because that was ditching something so associated with her. In a way, it's such a diss of Theresa May to say that. This was, I don't like that term. But you felt he had strength enough, A, to send the unauthorised tweet, but also then to say it, because he understood that the government was very weak on this. And I wonder if now, on the ongoing arguments about visas, whether he will just be able, he's now got some authority in that position, and almost moral authority, actually, as a member of the first member of an ethnic minority to be Home Secretary on this subject, whether he could now say to her, you know, this business of denying visas, for example, to doctors, would-be doctors in the NHS, story of the Evening Standard running today in London, that, you know, I think 100 vacancies that Indian doctors are ready to take up and Theresa May blocks them. You could just imagine him saying, just himself, without necessarily clearing it with Downing Street, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they should be here, and perhaps even moving on student visas, etc. He would now be able to, because Windrush was so bad for the government, he could actually forge his own path, whether he does or not, I don't know.
But there's a big leap, obviously, between the rhetoric and then the policy, and we're not there yet on that. You mentioned that Sajid Javid is the first British Asian Home Secretary. Is that significant?
Well, the juggling act that the Tories have, as they would see it, I suppose, are A, they need to keep their older white base, who particularly on issues of immigration and actually multiculturalism are very uneasy, and the fact they face an existential long-term crisis, which is not least that this is becoming a more diverse country, not least in the big cities where conservatism is in a state of collapse. One of the reasons, of course, the Tories lost their majority at the last election, and that's because the Tory share of the vote amongst black and minority ethnic Britons is exceptionally low. In London, I think it's now 14% support the Conservatives, which is catastrophic. And so I think what they're hoping with Sajid Javid is somehow they will be able to have this balance of, we will be tough on immigration, but somehow, you know, but we're comfortable with the diversity of modern Britain. I suppose the reality, though, is it isn't who you've put around the cabinet table, it's the policies themselves. And if they maintain the sort of rhetoric and the sorts of policies they've had on immigration and the rhetoric they've had on multiculturalism, and that included David Cameron, he did a speech, you know, he's presented this fluffy liberal Tory. He wants to do a speech basically renouncing or criticising multiculturalism in pretty strong terms. If they continue along that path, then, they face that long-term existential crisis. And what's happened to them in London will happen to them across the country, I think.
On that point, I think it's quite interesting. Our colleague Hugh Muir wrote a very good piece about all of this, and he noted that, which I'd forgotten, that Cameron got up to a third of black and minority ethnic voters voted Conservative in 2015. It was one of Labour's problems, Ed Miliband's problems then. That was a substantial, you know, substantial share. And I noticed, I think he must have been first out of the block, Stephen Bush, straight after Sajid Javid's appointment in the New Statesman, suggesting him as the John Major figure for the Conservatives. You could imagine there being talk of him as a future leader, partly for this reason. It wouldn't get all British Muslims to vote Tory, but it might get some of them. them. And
because it was affluent BME yeah. citizens who turned against the Tories at the last election.
Yes, and the point about that a lot of those voters is, in you know, they should really be conservative voters, many of them. They're, as many attitudes are socially conservative. These are people who are often, you know, owners of small businesses, or sometimes there's a constituency there. And you could imagine, credit to Stephen Bush, I just think the Sajid Javid talk as a leader, it depends totally how he handles this graveyard job, as Katie said, but you know, there's a logic there, because they really are, and we'll come on to talk about local elections, but in cities that are diverse, they are really far behind, and having a leading figure, let alone a leader, who's from one of Britain's ethnic minorities, that could help.
And of course, so much of it will come down to how he performs at the Home Office. And we ask this every time a Home Secretary resigns in disgrace, but is the job just too big for one person?
Well, it seems to me a kind of crazy job, and yet I remember when it was even bigger. I mean, the Home Office now is the slimmed down version. I mean, a whole chunk of what is now the Department of Culture, Broadcasting, that used to be under the Home Office, and now the Department of Justice didn't used to exist. That was also under the Home Office. It was extremely unwieldy, and in a way, because of Theresa May's mastery of detail, as Katie said, it went for 6 years, that was sort of forgotten in politics of what a minefield it is, because she did manage to thread her way through it. But, you know, I remember Jack Straw famously saying, there are people in this building every day who are doing things guaranteed to make me lose my job, because he knew that there was it's so big and sprawling, and in areas that really go to people's lives. And that's what we've seen again with Windrush. So, you know, if you mismanage in some departments, you can probably get away with it. But in the Home Office, my word, we know about it very quickly. But the May thing, slightly, she's the exception rather than the rule. The rule is that people, you know, come unstuck in this job, and we sort of have learned that anew with Amber Rudd.
Yeah, it was five Home Secretaries Labour got through in the last 6 years of power, didn't
they? Yeah, I mean, of those big offices of state, I mean, a Foreign Secretary, you can strut across the global stage, and perhaps not the case of Boris Johnson, but you can present yourself as a global statesman. If you're Chancellor of the Exchequer, you can do these very populist pledges and budgets and all the rest of it. It's difficult to see with Home Secretary how you can really shine and win a big popular base, but there's lots of reasons why your career can suddenly implode, and we've seen that over and over again with Home Secretaries.
And what do you think Javid needs to do, Owen, to prove to those people from his parents' generation that arrived in Britain before 1971 that they can feel confident in the system again?
Well, I think there's lots of problems looming for the Tories generally. I mean, take voter ID. Voter ID is used in the United States by the Republicans as part of an attempt to restrict the franchise, let's just be open about it, to more affluent white voters who tend to support the Republicans. We're now seeing that rolled out, well, it's being piloted in these local elections. The statistics are very clear that the poorest are less likely to have any form of voter ID, but people from black and minority ethnic communities who are overrepresented in poorer Britain are disproportionately less likely to have it. If we end up now, in a couple of years, over the coming years, with black and minority ethnic voters turning up to polling stations and being turned away, you can see then how very quickly people will say, you are not learning the lessons here at all, and you're even disenfranchising British citizens from minority backgrounds of the vote. So the issue now is, will they learn the lessons of Windrush, or will they just hope this particular scandal will dissipate? They will continue with the sorts of policies which are either appealing dog whistle wise to a certain constituency they need to, you know, particularly ex-UKIP voters, or will they think to themselves, well, actually, it's not worth risking these scandals and we need to embrace the Britain of the future? I have to say, given the nature of the Conservative membership and the fact they're still trying to hold on in small town and market town Britain to certain voters, I have to say, you can see how this scandal will replicate itself over and over again.
Katie, coming back to Sajid Javid, and of course today will be a test of where his loyalties lie in the Brexit inner cabinet, which is meeting. Do you think that his appointments and the change in personnel at May's top team will affect the Brexit calculus in the cabinet?
I think it changes it slightly, because with Amber Rudd, he had an ardent Remainer, so someone who was so vocal in the EU referendum campaign, that even though she was very well liked across her party, there was a small group of Brexiteers, and it was only a small portion of that wing, but they could never like her that much just because they remembered her in the EU debates, so couldn't trust her. Whereas Sajid Javid was a Remainer, but he was a very reluctant Remainer. He was someone who's known as being Eurosceptic, and that means that he's more likely, in a way, to side with the Brexit end than the Remain, but it will depend on the issues, because there are some things that he is, I think, more relaxed about. I don't think he has such an issue with the ECJ as some Brexiteers. But I think when it comes to things like the customs union, which is the big issue at the moment, he probably falls on the Brexit side rather than the Remain side. So
and
I think
he tweeted making that clear about the customs union.
Exactly. So he was quite quick when there were always reports about the customs union and how Theresa May may surrender on the issue, that this wouldn't be acceptable. So I think it does, it's a small win for the Brexiteers, but I don't think it would be on every Brexit issue the clearest way he'll fall.
Well, you can continue to follow all our reporting on this story at theguardian.com. On Thursday this week, the control of town halls up and down the country will be decided in this year's council elections. There are more than 4,000 seats available across 150 councils, including in all 32 London boroughs. Earlier, I spoke to one of the country's foremost experts in local government, Tony Travers at the London School of Economics. Tony, much of the focus in these elections has been on London. How do you think that they will play out both in the capital and beyond?
Well, most of the focus is on London because, of course, there are all-out elections in London. And last year, London performed rather differently to the country as a whole, producing a particularly good result for Labour in the general election. But, of course, there are more than half today's or tomorrow's contests are actually outside London. And that means we're going to get potentially quite different messages from inside the capital and from outside. And of course, in the Midlands and the north of England, in fact, the Conservatives did relatively rather better in the general election last year. And one might expect something of this pattern to emerge again this time with the Conservatives potentially winning seats that they hadn't won before in the outer parts of big cities in around Birmingham, around Manchester and Leeds and so on. But Labour gaining seats and possibly councils in London.
And so what impact do you think these results could have on the main party leaders and on the national political picture?
Well, it slightly depends on how far the results go in a particular direction. So if the results are not too bad for the Conservatives. So they lose some seats in London, but they win some or don't lose too many outside of London. Then I think that Theresa May, as with any government that's been in power for some time, would consider that just sort of midterm, what happens to parties that have been in power for some time, and not a significant blow for her. Having said that, if the Conservatives were to lose Wandsworth or Westminster or Trafford, actually, in Greater Manchester, I think those would be seen by party members as a bit rather bleak results. Westminster in particular, the home of the Palace of Westminster, being particularly totemic. For Labour, probably there's more at stake because Labour's now been out of power at the national level for 8 years, and an opposition party needs to be doing really well in local elections if it's to be able to show that it can win the following general election. So Labour ought to be doing well not only in London, but frankly in the rest of the country, and actually quite well. So I think the risk to Jeremy Corbyn is slightly greater than to Theresa May. And before we forget them, the Liberal Democrats need to show that they're beginning to make up some of the seats they've lost since they were in the coalition. And for Vince Cable and the Lib Dems, they need to be showing solid wins, or it looks as if the party is simply flatlining, not making much progress.
And looking at the councils themselves, what has changed for them in terms of budgets and powers since they were all up for election 4 years ago?
Well, since they were all up for election, they have seen the coming of more city regional mayors in a number of the areas. And it's worth remembering there'll be a city regional mayor in South Yorkshire tomorrow, a mayoral election, I should say, which Labour will, I assume, hope to win. And that, you know, potentially will put Dan Jarvis in an interesting position as he's the Labour candidate, as well as being an MP. But since the last elections, we've seen significant austerity, I mean, continuing austerity, which actually started in 2010, with council budgets continuing to be cut, though there has been some slight devolution, not only to city regions, but to other authorities as well, as the government seeks to balance the continuing reductions in spending with devolution policy. That's slightly lost traction, I think, since George Osborne, who was a big proponent of this, ceased to be Chancellor. We've seen now a succession of communities and local government type ministers without perhaps the same focus on it as Osborne used to have.
So politics continues to dominate the news, but do you think local people will care enough to actually come out and vote?
Well, turnouts in local elections tend to average sort of 35 to 40%. So that's well below the 65 to 70% that we get in general elections, reflecting the extent to which, you know, England within the UK, but it's true of Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, we have a centralised political system with a lot of power in Whitehall and Westminster, rather less in town halls. Having said that, there are good reasons to vote, because every time you step outside your front door, everything that's around you is run by a council or the council. So if you know, streets being swept, bins being emptied, street lighting, potholes, they may sound not that important, but actually for most of us in our daily lives, these things do matter. And of course, councils run, in many cases, adult social care, children's social care, elements of education. So there are good reasons for vote. You can have a better or a worse council, and by voting, you can affect that outcome.
I know you don't like being put on the spot about predictions, but since I have you here, I do want to tap into your London knowledge in particular and ask whether you think that the expectation that Labour could make serious inroads in the so-called crown jewel Tory councils in central London are likely to be accurate.
Well, I think Labour's somewhat allowed expectations to exceed the likely reality, and that always risks that it will be judged as, you know, a less good result than the expectations that have piled up might have implied. So in London, you've got Barnet as a very marginal borough. Hillingdon is quite marginal, also in outer London. Now, in a normal sort of circumstances, the swing from the Conservatives to Labour, which is shown up by polls, should carry at least Barnet, possibly Hillingdon, to either Labour control or at least no overall control. Westminster and Wandsworth are much more difficult for Labour to win, partly because of the safe wards in Westminster, and partly because Wandsworth and Westminster have had low council tax for many years, and the Conservatives fight hard to keep them. So I think they are less likely to go to Labour or no overall control. And of course, if that's how it turns out, I stress if, then, you know, Labour may win dozens of seats from the Conservatives in London across the city, but they may only win one, perhaps maximum two councils. They'll be up from 20 to 22, not a bad record, but not a kind of massive achievement, which I think is what they need at this point, having been out of power nationally for 8 years.
Tony Travers there. Oh, and expectations have been set pretty high by Labour this week. Too high?
Yeah, there's not been good expectations management either by the London Labour Party, Sadiq Khan, or by the national Labour leadership. Look, Labour got the highest share of the vote in London in the general election of any party in the history of democracy. There was a very interesting piece by George Eaton at the New Statesman talking about how London has shifted to the left, because in previous elections, back in 1992, for example, or 1987, the Tories actually did better in London than they did nationally as a share of the vote. That's very much not the case now. And, you know, his argument is the Tories are losing the Britain of the future. I think the issue is, look, Westminster has never been a Labour council, and Labour currently have about 14 councillors. Wandsworth was last 4 decades ago. Barnet has never had a majority either. Kensington certainly never been at Labour anywhere close. So it's very difficult, because, for example, in Wandsworth, the number of wards Labour needs to win in one go, they've never won in one go. The caveat, of course, is always we live in unprecedented times when Labour can win Canterbury and Kensington in a general election. But I think the problem is for Labour that you have older, more affluent white voters the most likely to vote, and they lean strongly towards the Conservatives. There is an unprecedented generational divide in political opinions at the moment, and that means it's particularly difficult for Labour, because those younger voters on local elections are least likely to vote. I've got younger people getting in touch with me asking me what local elections are, and so I think, you know, that will be the problem. It will be, can they mobilise? And given the battering, Windrush notwithstanding, Labour have had over the last few weeks. And given in a general election, you can get that battering, but you get broadcasting impartiality rules. Jeremy Corbyn can go on TV for an hour, present his case and shift political opinion. You can get a viral social media campaign because political interest goes up. You can have a manifesto that's transformative. Labour can offer very moderate, mild things in local government. There's not much local government can do. They've been cut to the bone. Their powers are limited. So it's very difficult for Labour to inspire enough people to shift it. So that will be the test.
And what do you think would be considered a good result for the Conservatives, Katie?
Well, I think, as Erin said, the expectation management by the Conservatives has been genius in some ways, because I was at an event last night with lots of Conservative MPs and people working it, but also people, you know, who aren't in the party, and everyone seemed to agree that if they could hold one of Westminster, Wandsworth or even Kensington, they could spin it as a success, which is crazy because if they only held one of them, that would be catastrophic really for the party, you'd think. But I think for them, all they need to do is, for the narrative, show that London is separate to the rest of the country. If they can paint London off as a, you know, well, London's doing its own thing, it's been turning red for so long and we kept one of them, then they feel like it won't say much about the Conservatives as a whole when it comes to the country and the national elections.
Do you agree with that, Jonathan? How much should we read into these results about the national state of the parties?
Well, the first thing I'll say is the expectations management game. There's a limit to how much the parties can do with that, because the polls, and I know we're more sceptical of polls than we used to be, but when Labour are at 50-something in the polls in London and the Tories are at 20-something, no matter how much expectations management you do, people are just going to expect certain outcomes because it's a huge, huge gap. I think this narrative that Katie mentioned about London is so interesting, because Theresa May herself and her brand of tourism would be extremely comfortable with that narrative that says London is this other planet, because in a way that was part of her Citizens of Nowhere message that fits her kind of ideological worldview, actually. And you see with the referendum, what was so interesting was that England that isn't London was massively for Leave, and England and London was for Remain. So, you know, there's a larger political story there than just polling. All that said, I think we can't read that much into it. Exactly a year ago, there were a disastrous set of local election results for Labour. And it was almost less than a month later, Labour did very well in the general election. So there was a gap there of 4 weeks. And yet they told totally different stories. So I think, and I remember when I said that Jeremy Corbyn has to take responsibility for these bad local election results, a howl of protest from Corbyn supporters who said, of course, the leader has nothing to do with what happens to local election results. I look forward to them echoing that point again on Friday when there are some fantastic results. And I'm sure they'll all be very quick to tell me that Corbyn deserves no credit because it's nothing to do with the leader. The point is, you have one outcome in early May. You can have a completely different outcome in early June. And that's partly because of the reason that Owen said that, you know, the national leaders are not exposed. They're not making their case. It just isn't that kind of campaign. So I think it is quite sort of self-contained, and we should probably read it that way.
I think what we did see, a big recovery in Labour's fortune between the locals and the general last year with the manifesto and so on, but nonetheless it was also the problem that the sorts of people enthused to vote for Labour in a general election are much less likely to vote in a local election. But it is out of London we should look out for Plymouth, for example, which is currently Tory controlled but relatively narrow majority. Trafford, Labour very unlikely to win it because only a third are up for grabs, but nonetheless, and they're quite hardcore Tory wars, a lot of them, but nonetheless, how well Labour does there will also be quite interesting as well. That was last held by Labour in 2004. Portsmouth, again, only a third up for grabs, but, you know, we will be able to look at those wards and it will be interesting to see how well Labour can do. But the question will be, it is about turnout, and it is a huge, huge challenge for Labour to turn out his vote in these local elections.
And last word to Katie on this. Do you think that the respective party leaders will be taking credit or indeed distancing themselves from the result?
I think Theresa may be quite keen to not be too closely associated with the result. But I think when it comes to these local elections, there are lots of Conservatives who are quite worried about London, not because they think, oh, we might only hold on to one council, but because it will feed into how the Conservatives approach the next general election. And there was already, I had a cabinet minister say to me that at the moment they're thinking for that election it would be more places like Bishop Auckland than places like Battersea. And if they do really badly in urban areas, that is going to push them away from even perhaps bothering to try and appeal to those voters. And that's very bad news for Liberal Conservatives.
Well, that's all we have time for now. My thanks to Jonathan Friedland, Katie Bowles and Owen Jones. Follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Pippa Carrera. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.